Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Wednesday, April 7th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's take a look at the weather as we begin today. Today's forecast calls for thunderstorms, a wind at the southeast at 15 to 25 miles per hour. There'll be a high of 70, 57, and a low of 42. Then on Saturday, partly sunny, high of 58, low of 41. Today's top weather story from meteorologist Kai O'Mara. After a stretch of milder days, we're going back into some cooler temperatures for the rest of the week. While this cool down isn't as notable as the last one, we'll still likely drop to the 50s for at least a few days. In addition, the weather will probably turn pretty cloudy as well. This type of pattern is not unusual for early April. Occasionally, these cool downs can last quite some time, 5 days or more on occasion. This is especially the case if a large high pressure system is blocking the pattern over the Great Lakes. That's today's top weather story from meteorologist Kai O'Mara. On today's front page, there's a story written by Marissa Payne of the Gazette, CR Flood Control Work Accelerates. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. As funding comes together for the city's $750 million permanent flood control system, residents in the coming years will see a marked uptick in construction of flood protection projects around Cedar Rapids. Nearly 30 projects are slated to come online in the next 4 years, with design and construction underway throughout the city. These projects will add flood control segments around Time Check and Cedar Lake, fortify the downtown area with floodgates and other enhancements, and bolster protection around Newbow and Check Village. Rob Davis, the city flood control manager, said local, state, and federal funding sources are kicking in, contributing to the increase in construction on the network of levees, flood walls, and gates on the east and west sides of the Cedar River. East side work by the Army Corps of Engineers is expected to wrap up in the next 3 to 4 years. But, Davis said, work on the system will continue for about 14 more years. Cedar Rapids officials had pressed federal officials for a decade after the 2008 flood for financial help in building flood protection. The city was threatened in 2016 by another nearly record crest of the Cedar River, and it was only through a Herculean effort to quickly erect temporary protections that another crisis was averted. Congress eventually approved $117 million to complete East Side flood protection, of which 65% would come from federal coffers and 35% from local funds. In 2013, the State Flood Mitigation Board awarded Cedar Rapids $269 million paid out over 20 years through sales tax revenues to cover roughly a third of the cost of the 7-mile flood system. Davis said this was the first year of ramped-up annual allocations to the city from $5 million to $15 million. And locally, in 2018, the City Council approved a 10-year, $200 million bonding plan to raise the property tax levy about 22 cents per $1,000 in taxable assessed value, increasing the municipal levy from 15.20. Davis said the city now is in the second year of that plan. City Council Member Tyler Olson, who chairs the Flood Control System Committee, said that the pace of construction shows the importance of the Council's actions to identify a local funding stream to match state and federal funds and to allow the city to keep up with construction of flood protection on the west side of the river. As each new segment is built, Olson said that carries the benefits of permanent protection in case of another high water event. Less time and financial resources are put into activating measures compared with propping up temporary protections. Olson said, "The more construction that people see, I think the more excited they are about the progress, but also the fact that when the city has said we're going to raise property taxes by 22 cents and put it toward flood protection, that it can be believed. Projects that will wrap up this year include demolition of Shaver Road Northeast Bridge to make way for an elevated structure north of Cedar Lake, construction of a permanent levee and gate well in Czech Village, a 2,100-foot flood wall around Quaker Oats, and a flood wall built into a new facility that doubles as a public restroom and storage space for events at McGrath Amphitheater. Here are some of the highlights for work planned in the coming years. For the north segment, the Time Check and Cedar Lake area, Northwest Neighborhood Detention Basins, there will be these will store excess water and slow it down to get it into the levee and pump it back into the river, helping reduce flash flooding in that neighborhood. One was built north of the Northwest Recreation Center in 2019. More are planned south of east of E Avenue Northwest and west of 28th Street, north of O Avenue Northwest, and west of Edgewood Road and south of O Avenue Northwest, and east of Highwood Drive. Davis said pump stations will be added, but those are mechanical. It's better for the pump stations, quote, if you can ease the water into it by storing it and letting it out in a more gentle rate, he said. The Northwest Quadrant Road improvements, E and F Avenues Northwest, eventually will be reconfigured to simplify the Before that work is done, 6th Street Northwest will be extended to Ellis Boulevard Northwest, an $8 million investment to open connectivity and incorporate permanent flood control into the Time Check neighborhood. The Cedar Valley Nature Trail improvements. A new levee and trail system will be added west of Shaver Road Northeast and south of McLeod Run. Davis said there will be a trail on top for pedestrian and bike traffic and some fishing areas on the base of the levee by Cedar Lake. The levee, he says, will separate the lake so that the floodwaters from Cedar River can't flood into the lake and the neighborhood, so that'll protect the lake environmentally. Davis said it will segregate the rail yard from the recreational components of the lake. Completed flood control measures in this area will safeguard property threatened when the river backs up into McLeod Run and Cedar Lake. The central segment features downtown and Kingston Village, the Tree of Five Seasons Park. The Tree of Five Seasons sculpture will be raised and realigned to make way for a levee. The park will be elevated, Davis said, allowing for views of the Cedar River and shielding a permanent full-height flood wall from view. A bike trail along the park at First Street will add a connection running under I-380 from the west side to the east side and to run on the banks of both sides of the river. Eventually, there will be new landscaping and tree plantings there. As far as the floodgates, work will begin this year on a roller floodgate at First Avenue East, similar to the 16th Avenue Southeast roller gate. The street will stay open with lane reductions and on-street parking restrictions, and temporarily traffic signals will be in place throughout construction. As businesses and City Hall prepare to welcome people back indoors with COVID-19 vaccinations increasing, Davis noted the traffic disruption may be an inconvenience, but projects take several years to plan, so it is not possible to pivot construction plans quickly. He said, "We want to make sure that people feel as welcomed as possible to get back in the building, so we're making sure pedestrian access will be available at all times to there, at least on one side of the road or the other, and have some parking put back. That includes temporarily allowing angle parking on part of First Avenue." A removable floodgate will be finished this summer at 3rd Avenue Southeast, and the road will reopen to traffic. A similar one is planned for 2nd Avenue Southeast in 2020. Taking a look at E and F Avenues Northeast, signals will be removed under I-380 before roller gates are installed there starting in 2022. Timing and phasing of construction is to be determined, but road closures will be required. The intersections can operate as an all-way stop, Davis said, and before removal will operate in red flash mode to help the public adjust to the impending change. 8th Avenue Bridge and Riverfront Improvements. The bridge will be elevated 15 feet, raised above the 2008 volume to stay open during floods. There currently are 7 piers in the river, and Davis says 6 will be removed, helping remove obstructions that slow water flow. This project will incorporate indoor and outdoor gathering spaces, complement the amphitheater, and have a trail component on both sides of the river. Looking at the Check segment, Newbow and Check Village, 12th Avenue Southeast Floodgate, similar to the gate that rolls across 16th Avenue Southeast, this project will pair with intersection improvements at 2nd Street Southeast to make way for a roundabout. The bridge's elevation means the west side does not require a floodgate. The road will be closed to traffic, but access will be maintained to the African American Museum of Iowa. National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library flood wall. A concrete wall will span from the 16th Avenue Southeast Gate to a proposed Czech Village pump station just south of the 12th Avenue Bridge, which will be the city's largest pump station to date. The project will include a raised, terraced yard to provide a space for the museum's outdoor activities and to minimize the appearance of the flood wall. On 16th Avenue Southwest's floodgate, this will be a roller gate paired with a decorative archway, complementing the aesthetics of the floodgate on the east side. It will include landscaping enhancement near the Czech Village clock tower. Davis said the city will close 16th Avenue in late September, avoiding traffic disruption there during the summer festival season. Other projects include an Otis Road Southeast storm sewer, a Czech Village underground stormwater gate, and a levee added to Newbow Lot 44 between 9th Avenue Southeast and 12th Avenue Southeast. Here's a front page story written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Governor awards moneyed in bonuses to 2 agency leaders. When Governor Kim Reynolds in January named Paul Trombino director of the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, she gave him a $40,000 retention bonus for his, quote, continued dedication and willingness to serve the people of Iowa. Within weeks, she replaced that bonus with a larger one, $46,176.40 on February 9th, bringing Trombino's pay for fiscal 2021 to over $158,000. The state-mandated salary cap for the Homeland Security Director is $112,000, according to the February 9th letter. Trombino, who's an engineer by training, started as Iowa DOT director from 2011 to 2016 under Governor Branstad, Reynolds' predecessor. In January 2019, Reynolds brought Trombino back to state government as her chief operations officer. In this position, Trombino coordinated, among other things, the state's $50 million contract with Workday, a California software company. Lawmakers criticized the deal for sidestepping traditional competitive bidding. As COVID-19 hit Iowa in March 2020, Trombino also was Reynolds' point person with the no-bid $26 million Test Iowa initiative, and officials from the Iowa Department of Public Health and the State Hygienic Laboratory had to route questions and requests about the deal through Trombino. Debbie Durham, who became director of the Iowa Economic Development Authority in 2010, has gotten retention bonuses many of her years in state government, and the Gazette reported in 2014 she had received 5 $30,700 bonuses since 2010 to keep her in the job. Durham's role grew in 2018 when Reynolds asked her to additionally take over leading the Iowa Finance Authority after the previous director was fired amid a sexual harassment investigation. Durham told the Sioux City Journal in March 2019 she had a private sector job lined up and was planning to leave state government when Reynolds offered her the finance authority on top of her other duties. Durham will make $204,300 this year, according to the January 7th bonus letter. To get that full bonuses, Durham and Trombino each must stay for 12 months from the dates of their letters. On the Iowa Today page, a story written by Grace King of the Gazette. I want every school to do what you do. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Fifth graders at the Kenwood Leadership Academy in Cedar Rapids led Iowa's top educator around their school Tuesday, telling her about their favorite classes, activities, and how they're learning to be leaders. The visit was part of Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Lebo's Spring School Tour, which focuses this year on work-based learning and hands-on, real-world experiences. Lebo said she is reviewing examples of learning that integrates technical and academic skills that will help students make decisions about their future careers. Michaela Lehman, age 10, Mokea Howard, age 11, and Anthony McCoy, age 11, led the tour with notes they had written and rehearsed. The Cedar Rapids Community School District is working to bolster innovative programming and equity, particularly in its magnet schools and at Hoover Elementary School, a designated community school with a large immigrant population. Kenwood President David Brandon said a recent survey showed 95% of families at Kenwood feel supported, valued, and heard by their child's teachers. The survey was completed by 186 out of the school's 220 families. Brandon said, "We're thinking not just about academics, but about developing the whole child." Kenwood's mission statement is to see, inspire, and empower students to be lifelong learners and leaders. Mocha said that is why she feels like she can choose what she wants to do someday, which is to be a graphic designer. Anthony said he likes having a voice at Kenwood and that he's learning how to work in teams. Before the pandemic, Michaela said she enjoyed speaking with business leaders about the 7 habits of highly effective people, such as beginning with the end in mind and putting first things first. Iowa Big, following her tour at Kenwood, Lebo visited Iowa's Big campus in the new Lubo area in Cedar Rapids, where high school students talked about their project-based learning. Prairie High School seniors Callie Brown and Alexis Goss introduced the projects they're spearheading that focus on social justice. Brown is creating a documentary about youth gun violence in Cedar Rapids, which she said is happening so often it sometimes flies under the radar. Gauss hosts a podcast called Power and Peace, where she talks about issues like police brutality and issues affecting the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community. Gauss said Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German has agreed to be a guest on the podcast at the end of April to talk about police brutality. Other projects that Iowa Big students are working on include welding branches to place in Czech Village, studying bacteria, and collecting luggage to donate to foster children. Lebo said, "When I listen to you all doing such different projects and being as passionate about it, I think every kid should have the same opportunity." Gauss said on her first day at Iowa Big, she was asked to make a list of what she's passionate about. It was tough. Today, she said she could write a book on what she's passionate about because of everything she's been able to explore at Iowa Big. Schools and communities need to come together to make work-based learning a possibility at all Iowa schools, according to Lebo, who said, "I want every school to do what you do, and it won't all look the same." Lebo was on to tour programs in Linmar and Marion school districts as well. Also on the Iowa Today page, a story written by Gage Miskimum of the Gazette, Marion looking for ideas to increase tourism. Dateline, Marion. The city of Marion is looking for ideas on how to increase tourism in their city. Any nonprofit or local government agency has until May 10th to apply for a grant that promises to increase the number of visitors to the city. The funding for the grants will come from the 7% tax collected on overnight stays in hotels and motels. Around $175,000 is expected to be available for the competitive grant program in the 2021-22 fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The tax has been in place since 1984. Marion plans to spend close to 100% of its motel-hotel revenues on the grant program, city accountant Bryant McKenzie said. The grant applications will be reviewed by city staff, city council members, and council-appointed citizens who will be recommending funding allocations to the city council. Projects that increase tourism and result in more overnight hotel-motel stays in Marion will be given priority. McKenzie said the grant program is split into two categories, City of Marion events and commissions and nonprofit organizations and events. McKenzie said, "We generally receive between 15 and 20 applications each year, and they are scored based on weighted criteria by our committee." McKenzie says it's difficult to say how much tax revenue was lost last year due to the pandemic, because the start of the pandemic coincided with the opening of the Town Place Suites by Marriott Hotel, which prompted an uptick in revenue. He said, "There is no doubt there has been an impact, but we are fortunate as a growing city. We hope that our hotel-motel revenue will continue to rise." The city expects to collect $205,000 in hotel-motel taxes this fiscal year. Grant applications are on the city's website. Awards are expected to be made June 17th during the Marion City Council meeting. Here's a state story that has local implications. State police report increase in use of force. State police officers in Iowa drew their guns and used force against suspects significantly more often in 2020 than in previous years due to a major increase in resistance. That's according to an internal report obtained by the Associated Press. Suspects fled in vehicles and on foot from officers working for the Iowa Department of Public Safety far more often in 2020 and were more likely to punch and kick officers and to threaten them with weapons, according to data in the department's annual use of force report. Officers, who include members of the Iowa State Patrol, responded by drawing their handguns, shotguns, and rifles 269 times last year, an 83% increase from the previous year, the report found. They also took or ordered suspects to the ground in dozens of more cases compared with 2019. While rare, officers also fired their weapons, deployed chemical spray, shot non-lethal munitions such as rubber bullets, intentionally struck vehicles, and used stun guns more often in 2020 than in 2019, the report found. Officers discharged their weapons in two cases in 2020, compared with none in 2019, killing one person, an armed man who had allegedly threatened to shoot a female hostage in Webster City. He was the only person killed in any of the incidents, while at least three dozen other suspects suffered visible injuries. 20 injuries to officers resulted in at least some medical treatment, while many other injuries were categorized as minor. Officers reported a substantial increase in subject resistance in 2020, resulting in a significant increase in officer force from the previous year. That's according to the report, which was approved March 24th by Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Bayens and obtained under the Open Records Law. The 22-page report did not seek to explain what was causing more suspects to resist officers and did not mention either the pandemic or the nationwide protests against racial injustice and police brutality. The increase in force cases began in January 2020 and continued most of the year across the state, decreasing only in April compared with 2019, according to the data. Just like 2019, blacks comprised a disproportionate number of those involved in the police encounters. Blacks make up about 4.1% of the state's population, but represented about 30% of those involved in the incidents, the report found. The data comes from detailed reports that officers must complete whenever they use force. The report highlights that force cases represent a tiny fraction of the 214,000 calls for service that officers were involved in, and that relatively few officers or suspects were seriously injured. Fewer than 1% of the incidents were determined to be violations of department policy. In a police-related story written by Kat Russell of the Gazette, Marion's new mental health liaison working with police. Dateline, Marion. Working in the field of mental health was not part of her career plan, says Brooks Big, the new Foundation 2 mental health liaison with the Marion Police Department. She said, recalling how a probation officer helped one of her best high school friends turn around her life, "My long-term goal was to be a probation officer with the Department of Corrections." So Big studied criminal justice at Purdue Global University, former Kaplan University, and then earned a master's degree from St. Ambrose in Davenport. After that, a mental health career just sort of landed in my lap, she said. She added, you know, when you're graduating, you're looking for any job that would be in your realm, and you're just applying like crazy, and that's what I did. So when I was offered a youth services position at Tanager Place in Cedar Rapids, I felt it would be a great opportunity for me. Turns out that working in the field of mental health was a good fit. She said, I loved every single bit of it. After nearly 8 years at Tanager Place, Big became a residential officer in a Department of Corrections halfway house. She said, I worked with their all-male population as they were transitioning back into the community. It was a big change from working with children, Big said, but it combined her longtime interest in probation and parole and her newfound interest in mental health. She said, a lot of what I did was offer supervision and support. One of the really big things we worked on was helping them pause and think before they gave into impulsive actions. Last year, Big said she saw the job posting for a mental health liaison for the Marion Police Department, and it was something that I just couldn't pass up. She said, I love that I am in a position to help people. She said, it piqued my interest because you really get to dabble with both worlds, the correction side and the mental health side, and bridge that gap between law enforcement and mental health. She went on to say, you know, police officers are not always equipped to understand and talk about mental health or deal with someone who is dealing with mental health issues, but they get phone calls like that practically every day. So that's where I can step in and help that person, maybe de-escalate a situation and make change. To identify if there's any gap in coverage and then follow up to see that they are getting the help they need. Brig started her position with the police department in January. Since then, she has had 39 face-to-face interactions with individuals in need of help, followed by multiple follow-up contacts. Roughly 65% have been stabilized and were able to remain in the community, and 15% were voluntarily hospitalized. 4 individuals were involuntarily hospitalized, and 1 was jailed. Big said, and those are just the face-to-face interactions. Those numbers don't include the individuals that police might encounter after hours and send my way to follow up. The police department is funding Big's first year through its budget, a $65,000 expenditure, and applying for state and federal grants to assist with the costs. Marion is the second police department in the corridor to add mental health liaison to its team. Cedar Rapids started its liaison program 3 years ago, which now employs 3 people, with plans for a second liaison. The Linn County Sheriff's Officer and the Iowa City Police Department both plan to add liaisons. Big said, it's been a great 2 months. It's been busy and chaotic. You know this is a new program, so there's been some learning curves, but I've really enjoyed working with the officers and meeting with people in the community. I love that I am in a position to help people. I work well in crisis, she said. Being able to walk in to de-escalate a situation and then walk that person through their options and connect them to the resources they need, it's a really good feeling. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's take a look at today's obituaries. First, we have these short other notices. From Cedar Rapids, Joseph Aker Sr., age 69, died Monday. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Cedar Rapids is in charge of those arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, Helen J. Hostack, age 92, died Tuesday. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge. From Independence, Albert C. Aldhouse, age 89, died Saturday. The Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence is in charge of those arrangements. From Waukon, Alice E. Thompson, age 89, formerly of Long Prairie, died Wednesday, March 17th. The Martin Graw Funeral Home in Waukon will be in charge of those arrangements. And from Wellman, Selena Barnes, age 81, died Monday, April 5th. The Powell Funeral Home of Wellman will assist the family. In the more extensive funeral announcements, John W. Will Burke, Jr., age 55, a resident of Aurora, Illinois since 1998, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away unexpectedly on Thursday, April 1st. Arrangements by the Frederick Jones Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Naperville, Illinois. For service times and a complete obituary, please visit the Frederick Jones Funeral Home website. Marine Alice Clavins, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, died this past Sunday at St. Luke's Hospital. As per the family's wishes, private services will be held at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, with burial in Czech National Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family. From Vinton, Larry Lee Pickering, age 80, died Monday at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 Friday morning at Trinity Lutheran Church in Vinton. Private family interment will follow at the Keystone Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Phillips Funeral Home Chapel at 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. The wearing of masks and social distancing will be practiced at the visitation and service. A memorial fund has been established. From Cedar Rapids, Allison Renee Moore, age 41, died after a short illness on Sunday, April 4th, at Mercy Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. this Saturday at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Family and friends may gather from 2 to 3 p.m. Saturday at the Legacy Center prior to the memorial service. Allison wished to be cremated, and a private burial will take place at a later date. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute pages for Allison. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Cedar Valley Humane Society or to the family, who will then direct them to other animal rescue facilities. Elaine A. Dull, age 64, of Maquoketa, passed away last Saturday at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Her funeral service will be held at 10:30 this Friday morning at Dawson Funeral Services in Maquoketa. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the funeral home, and burial will take place at Mount Hope Cemetery in Maquoketa. Pastor Brian William Gentz, age 73, of Washington, Iowa, died Thursday, April 1st, at his residence in Washington following complications of Parkinson's disease. Memorials have been established for the Parkinson's Foundation, the Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Iowa City, or Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Washington. Trudy Lynn Kesterson, age 49, of Cedar Rapids, died on Saturday, April 3rd, at her home. A visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. this Friday at the First Open Bible Church at 1911 East Avenue or E Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will take place the following week at 5 p.m. Saturday, April 17th, at the church. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. A live stream of the funeral service will be or may be accessed on the funeral home website. Before we head into today's sports report, let's go to community letters, and we do have one from Gary Ellis of Cedar Rapids. Gary says, the Biden administration has created a disaster at the border, a national security emergency, humanitarian disaster, and a public health threat. Biden created this situation by halting construction of the border wall and signing executive orders that wiped out immigration policy improvements made in the Trump administration. They claim our policy is more humane. When girls and women are molested and raped on caravans heading for the U.S., it is not humane. All are given a pregnancy test. Thousands of unaccompanied minors have crossed, with hundreds held in detention in migrant facilities, well beyond the legal limit. Cartels collect millions of dollars in head taxes, where Central Americans are charged $2,000 per person and others are charged up to $5,000. Criminals on the terror watch list have been apprehended. Border crossers have cartel wristbands for tracking. Biden's official policy statement is, quote, the border is closed, it's a challenge. Any reasonable person can see it's a cover-up. To top it off, the Biden administration has violated federal law. Congress funded border construction in 2020. The stoppage of construction is costing millions of taxpayers' dollars every day in penalties. I can't wait to hear the Democrats crying to raise taxes. And that is from Gary Ellis of Cedar Rapids. In sports, there's a story from Cedar Rapids about Kirkwood basketball. The Kirkwood men's basketball team won its quarterfinal matchup in the region tournament against Nyack last night, 94-74. Corvon Seals got 21 points, Blusson Kimball had 18, and Blake Brinkmeyer had 10 points and 15 rebounds to lead the Eagles. Kirkwood travels to Estherville for the semifinal matchup with Iowa Lakes Community College tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. In women's basketball from Cedar Rapids, Kirkwood advanced to the ICCAC Region 11A Finals with an 80-50 victory over visiting Ellsworth last night. The Eagles, now at 20-1, will host Southwestern on Saturday at 1 p.m., with the winner advancing to the National Junior College Athletic Association Division II National Tournament. Kirkwood finished with four players in double figures: Ashley Tull, Titania Hodges-Johnson, Tasha Jordan, and Corey Whitlock all had 10 points. In boys soccer, a story written by Nathan Ford of the Gazette, Prairie gets early statement win over West. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Projecting which Iowa high school boys soccer teams were poised for success was a tough task in 2021. After the 2020 season was wiped out, pegging traditional powers with at least some starters returning, like Iowa City West, was the safest bet. Better go ahead and count Cedar Rapids Prairie among the Mississippi Valley Conference contenders. All the Hawks did to follow up Saturday's home invitational, in which they beat Dubuque Hempstead 4-1 and Marshalltown 3-0, was go out and beat Iowa City West 2-1 in overtime at home last night. When sophomore Hunter Wilson laced home a penalty kick with 3:23 remaining in the first overtime, he gave Prairie just his third win over West in program history. That's 20-time state qualifier Iowa City West. That's 2019 Class 3A runner-up Iowa City West, with multiple seniors in the lineup who were all MVC as sophomores and an impact transfer up top. Coach Wilson said, "Pure excitement. We knew that we'd have a chance. They were starting to tire out, so we were ready." Prairie has been looked at as an emerging stalwart in its own right. The Hawks made their state debut in 2015, rather, and returned in 2017 after an undefeated regular season, and again in 2018. Well, with only three players back from a 2019 team, they went 12-7, including just one who played significant minutes. This team was looked at with a question mark from the outside. Prairie coach Kurt Lewis said, "We've got a standard and an expectation for our program. This is a whole new squad. They just played their hearts out tonight." West had multiple goals taken off the board, the first from Iowa City Liberty transfer Colby Godbolt early in the first half. He made up for it less than 6 minutes later with an eerily similar play in which he split two defenders and rocketed the ball past the goalkeeper. Lewis thought his young team looked shaky after that, but the Hawks got back in it when Blake Hallivan slid home a free kick from the top of the box with 17:04 remaining in the first half. Lewis said, "Once we got the equalizer, you could tell that we believed and could play and compete." In one other boys' soccer match yesterday, center pointer Urbana needed double overtime to beat Mount Vernon 1-0. In girls' tennis, Cedar Rapids Kennedy swept Wanderlust 9-0. Dubuque Waller topped Iowa City Liberty 6-3. In boys' golf, Lisbon won the Mount Vernon Invitational with 190 strokes, while in boys' track at the Bobcat Relays at Epworth, Cedar Rapids Kennedy won it with 144 points. Linmar finished third at 115. In the Williamsburg Invitational, it was won by Solon with 109 points. On the Iowa Today page, a story written by Gage Miskeman of the Gazette on today's COVID information. On Tuesday, Iowa added 507 new COVID-19 cases and 13 new confirmed deaths. The numbers bring state totals to just about 354,000 cases and 5,800 deaths since last March, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. The 7-day average for new cases in Iowa is 511, and the 7-day average for deaths is 15. As of yesterday afternoon, 648,324 Iowans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. That's 20.55% of all Iowans and 25.83% of all Iowans over age 16. Counting non-Iowans vaccinated in the state, over 675,000 people are vaccinated. As of yesterday, 1.674 million total vaccine doses have been administered in Iowa, with 1.612 doses going to Iowans themselves. In Linn County, 122,652 doses have been administered, and to date, 27.25% of the county's adult population are fully vaccinated. In Johnson County, 97,000 doses have been administered, with 38,000 county residents fully vaccinated. That's 31.05% of the county's adult population. Linn County added 22 new virus cases on Tuesday, bringing the county total to 19,998. The county's seven-day average is 24. Johnson County added its own 27 new cases, bringing its total to 13,698. Johnson County's seven-day average is 31. The 13 deaths reported Tuesday occurred between February 9th and this past Sunday. Of those seven were individuals aged, of those, seven were individuals age 81 and older, five were 61 to 80, and one was between 41 and 60. Polk County reported three of the deaths. Counties reporting one each were Bremer, Butler, Cerro Gordo, Crawford, Pottawatomie, Scott, Sioux, Tama, Wapello, and Warren. Across the state, 217 individuals were hospitalized with COVID-19 as of Tuesday, the highest number since February 25th. Patients in intensive care increased up to 52 from 47, and patients on ventilators increased from 23 to 27. Two long-term care facilities in Iowa continue to report COVID-19 outbreaks with three or more cases among residents and staff, with 19 individuals ill. To date, 2,281 have died from the virus in Iowa's care facilities since last March. Also from the Iowa Today page, a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, UIHC and state pay patient burn during procedure. The state of Iowa has agreed to pay a 60-year-old University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics patient $162,500 after an MRI machine severely burned and permanently injured her in 2017 while she was unconscious. The UI Physicians Group is paying half the amount, $81,250, and the other half is coming from the state's general fund. Lisa K. Brimmer of Henry County, in her lawsuit filed January 22, 2019 in Johnson County District Court, accuses UIHC and maker of the MRI equipment of negligence after she went in for a February 6, 2017 procedure related to her cervical cancer care. When UIHC personnel moved Brimmer into the MRI machine at issue, she was unconscious, according to the lawsuit. During treatment and while Brimmer was unconscious, UIHC allowed her body to come into contact with an extremely hot portion of the accident machine, severely and permanently burning her, according to the lawsuit. Brimmer sustained a third-degree burn to her left elbow before UIHC personnel noticed that the machine was injuring her, the lawsuit stated. Among the damages, Brimmer reports scarring, lasting pain, and permanent loss of feeling in her left hand and upper extremity. The state appeal board voted unanimously to approve the settlement. Here's a story written by James Q. Lynch of the Gazette. Legislative debate became a history lesson on the only Iowan elected to the White House as the Iowa House approved a tax credit to help raise funds for the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. The House voted 87-3 yesterday to approve the House bill, which would create a Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum tax credit to allow donors to claim a 25% deduction on their Iowa income taxes. The credit would be capped at $5 million, creating a 4-to-1 match to fund a $20 million renovation of the library and museum in West Branch, where our 31st president grew up. Typically, presidential museums are renovated every 12 to 15 years, according to Representative Bobby Kaufman of Wilton. The Hoover site has gone 28 years without renovations, the longest of any of the presidential libraries. Kaufman said the tax credit is a one-time request and will sunset after 3 years. There was bipartisan support for the tax credit, including from Democratic Representative Dave Jacoby of Coralville, who is reluctant to support additional tax credits until the legislature does a thorough review of all state tax credits. He says it's a great investment in a museum that, quite frankly, does a lot for the whole state of Iowa. In support of the bill, lawmakers noted Hoover's humanitarian efforts to feed millions of Europeans after World War I. He received 87 honorary degrees from American and European institutions, was made an honorary citizen of 24 European cities, and received nearly 500 medals, awards, and honors. Elected president in 1928, Hoover was blamed for policies that contributed to the Great Depression. The House concurred with the Senate on the bill for the state fire marshal to establish a local fire protection and emergency medical services provider program to make grants to volunteer fire departments for fireworks safety programs and equipment purchases. Also, that bill now goes to the governor. Taking a look at the arts, here's a story written by Diana Nolan of the Gazette, Acting Out While Staying In. While the pandemic is no laughing matter, four playwrights have found humor hiding in everyday situations and frustrations that mirror the past year. They've turned their musings into three original short plays, taking place in a living room and designed to be viewed in a living room or wherever audience members kick back to stream shows at home. Presented by City Circle Theater Company, Acting Out While Staying In will be available online from 4 o'clock Friday through 11:45 Sunday night. All three shows were rehearsed separately, then filmed on separate days in March, using the same basic living room setting at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts. Elizabeth Tracy, the City Circle's artistic producer, reached out to the veteran writers, who in turn chose separate casts and directors for each 30-minute comedy. Here's a glimpse into each, along with more comments from email interviewers with the Gazette. Working for a laugh, a newly single stand-up comedian discovers he's not the only one trapped in his apartment. It stars Michael Pennock, written by Janet Story Schlepp Cole, and her son Paul David Story, and is directed by Kristen Newman. And Quarantine Makes Three. When a pandemic puts a strain on Kate and David's relationship, they try to get away from it all, but a bellhop inadvertently gets wrapped up in their troubles. It stars Greg Tucker, Emily McKnight, and Melanie Chervak. Was written by Brian Tanner, directed by Andrea Jean Maurice. Scandinavian Death Cleaning. Cleaning house. The phrase can have as many meanings. Simple maintenance of one's home to an overhead of one's whole life. Walter and Marie are considering cleaning house. Their son, Matt, watches from the distance of social media. Hilarity might ensue, or maybe just some kind of understanding. Starring Ron Clark, Jody Hovland, and Patrick Delaney, written and directed by Christopher Okishi. Much like Plaza Suite by Neil Simon, it's three independent stories told using the same set, said Okishi of Iowa City. Contacted in late December, the writers had about 2 months to craft their scripts, and inevitably, the pandemic that's on everyone's mind found its way into the plays, either overtly or between the lines. Tanner of North Liberty even put Quarantine in his title, saying the plot revolves mainly around the struggles with the pandemic that I feel like everyone can relate to. While the pandemic is a backdrop to the story, it's more about how people are coping with it. I certainly didn't want to make light of the issue, as it's a very serious matter. But I think this script is more about these characters and how they handle the situation they're in. To shape Working for a Laugh, Schlappkohl of rural Iowa City, who's a graduate of the University of Iowa's playwriting program, reached out to her son, a Broadway, television, and film actor in Pasadena, California, who also has written plays. In their first collaboration, Schlappkohl said their inspiration came from conversation with family and friends, discussed and laughed over with her son. She said, "We looked at the theme of isolation, careers being on hold, navigating relationships. We chose not to have a direct reflection of the pandemic, but the emotional themes are present." Story added, "We talked about being sequestered and alone, strenuous efforts to be comedic when there didn't appear to be much impetus in one's current given circumstances, steering a course through breakups, moves, career challenges, and relationships. The pandemic is not directly mentioned, but the influence of it is perceptible. Tanner built directly on the pandemic for his "And Quarantine Makes Three." He said, "I keyed in on the fact that we were coming up on a year since things locked down. I considered the toll that the pandemic situation might have on a relationship and how a couple might try to come to terms with that. Then I kicked up the absurdity for comedic effect." Timing was everything for Okishi in forming the plot for Scandinavian Death Cleaning, mixing some autobiographical situations with the pandemic as a springboard. He said, "I was listening to an NPR story about a design trend noted in Europe and the Eastern U.S. when my mother called to offer me the rocking chair from my childhood bedroom. An hour later, Liz Tracy called and asked if I had an idea for a play. I am very grateful for the rocker, which is in our living room now and getting plenty of use." While he doesn't want to give away any surprises, he noted that the play asks some questions many of us have asked during this pandemic time. What do all the things we keep in our houses really mean? And does that meaning change as we age? And is frequently a comic look at this idea. He said, "I hope people will see the themes as part of us moving on from the time and getting back to the business of living and loving each other." He cast married couple Clark and Hovland as reimagined versions of his parents, and his husband, Dulaney, as a character based on Okishi and his brother John. What he wasn't prepared for was his reaction to rehearsing the autobiographical aspects of his script. He said, "I was not as emotionally prepared as I needed to be to direct people to play versions of my family. And because I most frequently chat with my folks while driving home from work, I would often talk to my real live parents, then begin a rehearsal with the fictionalized version of them. It was a bit of whiplash, but it was all mitigated by the superlative cast who asked the right questions, brought the best ideas, and made this process a dream. All of the playwrights were grateful to have this artistic outlet during the pandemic. Okishi, who is a psychiatrist, is keenly aware of the isolating effects and lack of work, especially for the artistic community. He said, "I have been very fortunate to continue with some creative outlets, including SPT's online offerings and several pieces for Riverside Theater. I shudder to think what the pandemic would have been like without these outlets, and I am so grateful to have been able to keep going." He said, "I love my work, and I love being a doctor, and I constantly work with people whom I remind, and who remind me, that caring for oneself means making time and space to do everything that feeds your soul." Here's an Eastern Iowa brief about the Grant Wood Studio. Its studio and Armstrong Visitor Center will be reopening for the season at noon on Saturday. Admission to the studio is free for everyone during regular studio hours, courtesy of a grant from the Esther and Robert Armstrong Charitable Trust. Grant Wood comes to life in this light-filled, inspirational loft known as the Grant Wood Studio. Wood lived and worked in the studio from 1924 through 1935. Visitors can observe the decorative details and craftsmanship that went into transforming the loft into a studio, performance space, and living quarters. Visitors also stand in the very spot where Wood painted some of his most famous works, including American Gothic. The experience continues with a visit to the nearby Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, which houses the world's largest collection of artwork by Grant Wood. Face masks are required, and the studio tours are limited to groups of 10 people at a time. Tours begin on the half hour, and all COVID precautions have been implemented for visitors' safety. The Grant Wood studio hours are noon to 4 Saturday and Sunday, and the studio is at 810 2nd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, April 7th. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.